You're listening to the Sixers Beat with your host, Derek Bodner, right here on LibertyBallers.com and LibertyBroadcast.co.
Welcome, everybody. This is Derek Bodner, and we're back with the Sixers Beat. We do have a couple of announcements that we want to start the show off with. First of all, it is the first week in January. It's a time when New Year's resolutions are made. And for the vast majority of resolutions, I believe they're BS. Not all of them and not for everybody. But generally speaking, if you had the desire and the dedication to be doing something, you'd probably already be doing it. You wouldn't be waiting for an arbitrary date in the middle of winter to start. For all those people that are now trying to lose weight, only a tiny fraction of a percent of those will still be doing so in March. Now, after spending the introduction of the show trashing New Year's resolutions, my New Year's resolutions is to seriously do podcasting. I'm going to do a weekly podcast. I'm going to do it. And on that front, we've teamed up with Liberty Broadcast. They're the guys with Tony Bruno, with Bleeding Green Nation, with Jimmy Kemsky, Eitan Shander, and more to come. So we're excited about that. We're excited about that partnership. And we're excited to be joining that team. For the second part, I've always kind of done this show with Rich Hoffman, and the plan is for Rich to still be coming on the show when he can. If you haven't heard, Rich started working for a new digital media venture called Philly Voice, the same place that Jimmy Kemsky is going to write for, where he'll be writing about the Sixers, the Phillies, the Flyers, and other Philadelphia sports topics. In fact, I actually saw Rich last night at the Sixers game where he was covering the Sixers. So we're excited about that opportunity for Rich. So depending on Rich's work schedule, how much free time he has, he will be joining us when he can. That being said, we're going to be bringing in Kyle Newbeck as well, both so we can make this podcast a more regular thing, and also because having another great basketball guy on the show, in addition to Rich, to talk about the team on a regular basis is always welcome. So today we've got Kyle Newbeck here. He's also from Liberty Ballers, among about half the sites on the internet.
So I've been around, yeah.
We welcome Kyle, and how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I guess I'll bring a little bit of a different approach to this than you and Rich. You guys are a little more reasoned and rational, I think, than I can be. So maybe I'll spice things up a little bit.
Spice is never bad. Two reasoned people can get boring to listen to. And frankly, I'm surprised anybody listens to random people talk about these Sixers anyway.
It's pretty amazing when you think about it.
It's pretty amazing that people care about the team, that read about the team, watch the team. You can go from, you know, Liberty Ballers, which I think is in the top six or seven in all of SB Nation's NBA program, which amazes me because you go to a game and there's 8,000 people at the game. But, you know, it's great that the fan base, not the entire fan base, but a good chunk of the fan base has bought into what the Sixers are doing, is interested in watching the development of guys like Michael Carter-Williams, Joel Embiid when he can finally play, Nerlens Noel, and even guys like Robert Covington that you pick up off the scrap heaps, guys like Furkan Aldemir, who, you know, he's so far been, as advertised, not an offensive threat, but will rebound on both sides of the court. But for fans to really buy in, enjoy watching these guys develop, and get invested in a team like that, it's been surprising to me, but fun as well.
Yeah, I think. And even last night in the game that ultimately is meaningless in terms of where they'll end up in the standings and all that, it was pretty cool just to see the crowd come together as they took on Cleveland, which even though LeBron and Kyrie weren't playing, they still kind of have a target on their backs among casual basketball fans. So to see them get hyped for Michael Carter-Williams and Roten and Covington kind of going nose-to-nose with those guys, that was really cool. And I hope that's a sign of things to come when this team eventually turns the corner and they have all the pieces in place.
Right. And if you kind of take a 50,000-foot view of the thing, yeah, you played Cleveland without LeBron James, without Kyrie Irving, without Dion Waiters, with nine available people to play. Great. Congratulations. You won that game at home when Cleveland was on the second half of a back-to-back with no available bodies. But when you sit there and you're watching it, and they had a really big crowd last night, and a big reason for that was LeBron James coming to town and people buying tickets before he announced that, you know, he was sitting out for his injury, before Kyrie Irving announced that he wasn't going to be able to play. And the Sixers charging a surcharge for that and not really coming down off of that. And if I had to pick one thing I really disagree with on a team and what they're doing, it might be the ticket prices. But to have 17,000, 18,000 people in that stadium for a game where, again, Cleveland back-to-back, no available players, missing superstars. But to come back from 17 points down in the second half, to watch guys like Robert Covington shutting down Kevin Love on that final play and denying him the ball, to watch Tony Roten making big shots, to watch Michael Carter-Williams adjust the play after Brett Brown called it because he saw something in the defense that had been happening throughout the game and thought he could take advantage of it, and it working. To see it all come together like that, it might not mean anything. Of course, it does mean something because the Knicks made a trade, trading away two guys who were playing 26 minutes a game, one healthy, and now the Sixers are actually the third worst record in the league. So it means something, but not meaning something to the larger NBA landscape, it certainly meant something to us.
Absolutely. And I think it was very cool that after the game, whether that was on Twitter or in interviews, the players acknowledged how much they wanted to win it, not just for themselves, but for the fans. And so I think they see how into this the diehards of this fan base are. And it's nice to see that even though they're young and they're inexperienced in many parts of the imagination, that they can still appreciate that the fans are pulling for them and can see the flashes more so than the consistent production, and they appreciate that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we look at this. We talked about it just a couple seconds ago of Michael Carter-Williams adjusting the play and that growth as a point guard and really as a floor general. And maybe long-term it doesn't mean anything. Maybe Michael Carter-Williams never improves that jump shot. He's never a long-term piece. He doesn't fit with Joel Embiid and whoever they draft later. But just seeing that, having that option, seeing that progression, even if we're just talking about Brett Brown as a teacher, as an ability to get young guys to buy into the system, buy in, even though they're not seeing the results on the court, to really put in the work, it bodes nothing but well for the Sixers.
Yeah, I can't tell you how shocked I've been by Robert Covington. I thought that guy he'd at least bring some...
He's a patsy.
Yeah. Well, in fairness, Deadspin did just write a column killing the Knicks for the J.R. Smith trade dump, but...
Well, at least they're consistent.
Yeah. But yeah, I thought Covington would bring something to the table, but I never would have imagined that he'd have this immediate of an impact on the team. And I think it's pretty amazing that Sam Hinkie and the Sixers as a whole can just find these guys that seemingly are off the scrap heap and turn them into something and let them grow into something greater.
No, and I mean, you look at the guys he's brought in, you know, with assets that may not have been the greatest. He brings in KJ McDaniels because he's a unique defensive player who can block shots from the wing. He comes in, what does he do? He blocks shots from the wing. He's got, he's among the league leaders in blocks from a shooting guard or small forward. I'm pretty sure he is a league leader, actually. He brings in Furkan Aldemir, who's not a whole lot of an offensive threat, but he can rebound. And so far, he's got a 17.9% offensive rebounding percentage and a 29.7% defensive rebounding percentage. Put that in perspective, the Sixers' second best regular player in terms of offensive rebounding was Brandon Davies at 9.6%, just over half of what Aldemir is doing. And their second best defensive rebounder is Zerlens Noel at 19.6%. So he's dominating on the glass. Another guy, bringing in Nerlens Noel, who's again blocking shots, being a rim protector. He's bringing in guys who have roles, who have NBA skills, and those NBA skills right now are translating. Which again, bringing in Furkan Aldemir, being at games, being at the practices, seeing him work before games, shoot arounds, he's kind of showed maybe a 15-foot baseline jumper that he didn't really show in Turkey. Galatasaray, I think he legitimately attempted one jump shot all year, and that's just the role they had him playing. They wanted him crashing the offensive glass and doing pick and dives, diving towards the hoop and finishing down there. I'm not sure he necessarily gets as much of his offense doing that in the NBA, because I'm not sure he has the athleticism, the explosiveness to have the same kind of success against NBA defenders. So if he actually has 15-foot jumper, You know, that might be he might have a little more offensive potential than maybe I gave him credit for, although he hasn't really shown it in the game yet. But the fact that he had an NBA skill, Hinkie correctly identified it, even if Aldemir is only a 10 to 15 minute per game player, the fact that he's correctly identifying these NBA skills is again, another good sign for the Sixers going forward.
Yeah, I think it's very encouraging, and it certainly coincides with a philosophy that I think you and myself and the rest of the people at Liberty Ballers have kind of preached, where either they're going to get guys that have definitive skills like Aldemir or like McDaniels with his blocks, or they're going to roll the dice on somebody like Jakar Sampson, who, while he's extremely raw, you can see the type of just athletic talent that he has and the NBA body that he has, and that if they truly believe in their development process and what they can kind of coach these players into, that if they can get even 75% of his potential out of him, that there's really something in there.
Right. And I think if you look at where they are in their phase, and I think we kind of get a little too overblown right now on what represents a Sam Hinkie player. But I think the common thread, as much as length and athleticism, and certainly they've targeted that, are players that, if they improve something, can drastically outshoot what they gave up for them. And guys like Jakar Sampson obviously gave up nothing for him. So if he improves his jump shot, you know, they can he can maybe become something. Guys like KJ McDaniels, if he becomes a reliable corner three-point shooter, he's going to be worth far more than a second-round pick. Even Michael Carter-Williams, you know, if he had a jump shot right now, he would be a very legitimate point guard. And getting him for the 11th pick, I mean, he already won Rookie of the Year, and we can debate whether or not that has a whole lot of merit. But if he improves his jump shot, he's going to be worth drastically more than what they gave up for him. And a guy like Furkan Aldemir, he might not be your prototypical length, athleticism, run the floor, you know, block shots, beat guys with his explosiveness. But if he improves his jump shot, then all of a sudden you've got a big man who's a legitimate 6'9", has some strength in the post, who can rebound on both sides of the court, and now all of a sudden he can make a jump shot. So if he adds that to his game, then he's drastically exceeded, you know, whatever little bit. And really, they only gave up the cap space to absorb and keep Royce White on the roster for a couple weeks. That's all they really gave up. So if he improves, shows a jump shot, then again, he's drastically improved, outshot his projection and what they give up for him. And I think really, as much as length and athleticism, all that stuff, that's what the Sixers are going for right now. And so far, I think that's what they're getting.
Yeah, and I think it's easy to forget when you're within the moment of the game that you're going to need a fairly deep roster once you actually are going to compete and try to push for the playoffs. And I think it's easy to go out and get kind of those mid-level veteran type guys that they'll bring something to the table. So at this stage of the game, I'd much rather see them swinging for the fences and going for that high upside and looking for guys that will have a clear role going forward. And then once they figure out, or once they obtain their true franchise players, which we all hope Joel Embiid is one of them, that they can kind of just plug in from there. And they already have a fairly firm roster and identity in place. Then that's when the supplementary moves will start to take place.
Right. And those guys with the clear role that you just mentioned, when we look at Robert Covington, you brought him up just a couple minutes ago. When we look at Robert Covington and why we're so excited about him, I mean, you want to talk about a guy with a clear role. When you start getting Joel Embiid on the court and you start getting Karl Towns or Jahlil Okafor, or whoever we end up getting in the 2015 draft, and you have a shooter like that and a guy with such a quick release, such a repeatable release, who gets good elevation on his jump shot and he's hard to contest. I mean, you can just go back to that game last night, the game-winning shot by Tony Roten. And when he started driving to the hoop, four of the five Cleveland Cavalier defenders just they collapsed on him. The one guy who didn't was the guy Robert Covington was being guarded by. So when you start having an inside-out post presence, a guy who in Joel Embiid can cause a double team, or a guy like Jahlil Okafor, who's such a great passer out of a double team, a guy like Robert Covington, as great as he's playing, and you look at him right now, I think I looked at all the top, from the last two drafts, there have been 28 lottery picks. Robert Covington has pretty much this year outproduced all but two of those lottery picks. And you're looking at that right now, and he really has nobody who can really generate an open look for him, who can consistently get you know, space for him and a good catch and shoot look. So when you start adding guys like dominant post presences, maybe a pick and roll point guard, he's a guy who's very, very, very easy to project to have a future role on his team. And Sam Hinkie got him for $800,000 on a 4-year deal.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing when you think about it. I look at Covington and I almost think that he is who we want Hollis Thompson to be. I think Hollis Thompson over the last season and a half has gotten a lot of similar looks to Robert Covington. And for one reason or another, he's sometimes a little more hesitant to pull the trigger and just let it fly. And I don't know if it's because Covington played in the D League last year, and down there it's a very offensive minded, just get your
complete and total free reign.
Right. So he kind of has already been in an environment where if you're open, let it fly was the philosophy. So I think you're kind of seeing the results of that now that he's in an NBA environment where he can do the same thing, it comes naturally to him. So I wonder if possibly if they send Hollis Thompson for a little rehab stint to the D League after he recovers from this illness he's been dealing with, whether that might benefit him in the short and the long term.
Yeah, and he's another guy that a lot of people are down on. They expected more from him this year, and it's reasonable. It was reasonable to expect him to take a bigger jump, and he's really struggled with the consistency in his outside jump shot. All these things are completely and utterly reasonable. That being said, a guy like him who has that kind of a jump shot, who's pretty quick on the release, and who can defend at least at an adequate level, it makes sense to, you know, really give him time, you know, to see if he can figure it out. Not to be a starter. I don't think Hollis Thompson's ever going to be a starter on a good team. But whether or not he can be a 6th, 7th, 8th guy, you know, I don't think that ship has sailed. And I think maybe we're a little too hard on him. Not so much that our expectations are unreasonable, but that we discarded him a little bit too quickly.
Yeah, and it's easy to forget, but he's still averaging 4 3-point attempts per game, which that might not be his ideal role to have to shoot a lot. I mean, per 36, I think he's averaging over 5. So in a small window of time, he's jacking up a lot of shots. And for a guy who shouldn't be expected to have a big role, he's being thrust into this big role. So you have to kind of see the forest for the trees here and think about Hollis Thompson, not as future starter Hollis Thompson, but future role player. And that if they scale back his minutes and ask him to do less, whether he'd be better suited. And I think you could see last year when he was asked to do less, he converted at a higher rate and was more successful at having a positive impact on the team.
Right. I think if we look at Hollis as a 15 to 20 minute per game guy, who's really only there to hit 1 or 2 threes a game and stretch the floor and give them minutes on the wing without really compromising their offense, I think our perspective changes quite a bit. All right. Moving on, though. Next topic. A big topic right now has been MCW, Tony Roten. Picking a side, not that there's really any reason to pick a side. But especially coming off of last night's game, where the two of them were really dynamic. I think they accounted for all but one basket in the fourth quarter between making shots and assists. MCW had 13 assists to 1 turnover. Roten had 8 assists in the game-winning shot. So the tone of this might not be really in place considering what happened. But it's a big topic in Sixer Lane. It's coming off of Rookie of the Year season. I think people expected that Michael Carter Williams was a piece that they could kind of count on. And in many ways, he's taken a step back. So MCW wrote in general thoughts, not necessarily picking a side, but what you think about their play and really more importantly, their future on the team.
Well, I think part of this boils down to what people like aesthetically in basketball players. Like, I think certainly from my own point of view, Tony Roten just seems more exciting to watch when he's on because he's just so devastatingly quick and he gets to the rim like no one I've ever seen, at least no one I've ever seen that doesn't also have a jump shot they can threaten people with. And so I think people, they think of these Hollywood style passes that he throws cross court or behind his head and they
see, over his shoulder. Yeah. I've never seen somebody throw so many hook shot passes in my life.
And it's wildly entertaining because we don't really have to worry about results right now. And you can kind of just let them work out the kinks. And I actually, it makes me think of like people being a little bored or angry with Michael Carter Williams. Reminds me of how people are constantly trying to dethrone Chris Paul as the best point guard in the league. And this year, there's some argument with how Steph Curry is playing, because generally Chris Paul's teams play at sort of a methodical pace and he dissects the game rather than just destroying people a la Russell Westbrook or Stephen Curry with a barrage of threes. And so they underappreciate him. And I think last night is a game where Michael Carter Williams kind of goes a little underappreciated because Tony Roten had the game-winning shot and a couple big buckets on the stretch. But Michael Carter Williams had, I believe, one turnover and something like 13 assists. Yep. So he really had a huge impact on that game, even though you wouldn't say he necessarily put his stamp on it to end it. So I think sometimes we forget how much of an impact a guy like him can have when his teammates are hitting shots.
Right. No, and I mean, you look at Roten, and I think he scored 9 points in the last 3 or 4 minutes of the game, including, obviously, the game winner. For that to happen, I mean, it's always going to draw attention. It's not necessarily wrong to pay attention to it. You score 9 points at any time during the game over a 3-minute stretch, and it's noteworthy. But to do it, with the game on the line, it's naturally going to grab people's attention. But you're right. For Michael Carter Williams, he had gone weeks and weeks without having a game of 3 turnovers or less. He's number one in the league in turnovers per game. If you look at it on a per possession basis, both of them are in the top 10 or 12. I forget exactly where they rank. But you're talking about a duo right now that are number one, number two in the league in turnovers per game. For him to come out with a 13-1 assist to turnover ratio. And again, this, you got to really kind of put it in context. This is a Cleveland Cavaliers. They really offer no rim protection. They don't, especially with this lineup, offer a whole lot in terms of denying dribble penetration. So it was kind of tailor-made for guys like Michael Carter-Williams and Roten to go out there and have success. But by the same token, they were also helped by the lineups that they were playing with. Luke Bamute, I think at this point would probably underrate him. He has legitimately been good on the defensive side of the ball. And he's been kind of that kind of versatile defender that Brett Brown, really needs. But by the same token, they started with KJ McDaniels. They started with Robert Covington. And they started with Henry Sims, who, while he might not have 3-point range, he certainly has, 17 feet baseline range, mid-range jumper range. And those three really probably helped space the floor more than they typically get. So the combination of the Cavs not being a good team, a perimeter defensive team, not offering a whole lot in terms of protection at the rim to really dissuade Roten and Michael Carter-Williams from driving, and having actual three-point threats on the perimeter, it was tailor-made for them to have good games, but not to that level. Like, anytime you have a 13-1 assist to turnover game, you played well. And I think that's true for both of them.
Yeah, it was a very encouraging thing after I had said to somebody in the Liberty Ballers comment section that I hoped Michael Carter-Williams could pull out a good game, because he certainly has been in a bit of a funk lately, and that's really what's allowed this MCW versus Roten discussion to thrive. And I think people have gotten trapped in this, well, we don't know if he'll be a top 10 or top 15 point guard in the league, or wherever the arbitrary signpost is that you want to throw into the debate. But I'm just looking for him to excel at what his role is and what he is best suited to do. And that's setting the table for his teammates. So while some nights that's just not going to happen because the Sixers just don't have guys who are great shooters, and they're kind of throwing away individual wins and losses for the sake of development, which is something that we're all behind. So there are nights when he's going to throw passes to Nerlens Noel and they're going to bounce off his hands and there's nothing he can really do about it.
As most passes do.
Yeah, so those kind of things are going to happen. And people get trapped inside the numbers sometimes, and they see, oh, well, Michael Carter Williams had X amount of turnovers. And while, yes, on some nights, it gets pretty ugly and a lot of it is his fault, there are times when it's just totally outside of his control. And I think people really do need to be patient with him, as they are with Roten. It's just that the expectation level is different for Michael Carter Williams because of his inclusion, for better or for worse, in that whole rebuild process with Drew Holiday going out and he having to step in as the immediate replacement.
Right. And I think, I mean, turnovers, I'm not going to say they're not a legitimate concern. They definitely are. And you can go back to how these guys played in college. You know, Michael Carter Williams having turnover problems at Syracuse. Pretty much both of their entire career right now. And you need to see improvement on that. And they certainly both can improve their decision making. Michael Carter Williams can improve his handle in traffic. These turnovers are not, they're not just the result of, or even primarily the result of their teammates. That being said, I do think this is one of the areas where their teammates hurt them, at least in terms of our evaluation of what is an insurmountable problem and what is exacerbated by the situation. Turnovers to me are the most legitimate. You know, it's hard to operate without space. If you're driving down a lane and you got three sets of hands reaching in trying to poke it away rather than just one set of hand, you're going to turn the ball over more. If you don't have a good kickout valve, you're going to struggle with that. And I think hopefully as the season goes on, you know, with Covington now emerging as, you know, he's pretty much playing as much as anyone on the team right now, with hopefully KJ finding his stroke, and he's lost that for well over a month now, and that's why it was nice to see him hit a couple of three-pointers last night. You know, maybe even with Jason Richardson coming back, which looks like more and more like it could be a possibility. Hopefully the more we get legitimate shooters around there and more of a semblance of a legitimate half-court offense, the better we can evaluate these guys. Because right now, you know, Michael Carter-Williams entering last night's game had a 1.4-1 assist-to-turnover ratio in the half-court. Tony Roten had a 1.2-1. So these are guys right now that have been thriving off of being able to push tempo. And that's really right now probably Michael Carter-Williams' greatest strength, is being able to push tempo and find people in transition. But evaluating them in the half court right now is difficult, so hopefully we can do that a little bit better in the future. That being said, the one area I'm not really going to give them, either of them, a free pass on is their 3-point shooting, and that to me is more important than the turnovers, at least at this stage in their development. Turnovers improve with experience, improve with personnel. They have got to start making some improvements on their jump shot, or I just can't see, especially as we build around Joel Embiid and what we're going to need as a good point guard option for him, as we build around a Karl Towns or a Jahlil Okafor or whichever one ends up, even a slashing guard. You know, if you look at probably the only one right now who wouldn't put a huge question mark in both of these players' future is Kristaps Porzingis, just because he's such a good shooter from the power forward spot and can open up the lane without necessarily needing a great shooter next to him. But you're going to need a shooter for a slashing wing. You're going to need a shooter for a post-up big man. You're going to need a shooter even from a high post big man, which Karl Towns could become. So we really need to see progress in this for me to have much faith in their ability to be that ideal point guard for Joel Embiid.
Yeah, well, I think it's fascinating to me that for so many of these guys, and not just Michael Carter-Williams and Tony Roten, but many of the guys who are considered the top-level draft prospects in this upcoming draft, that shooting is almost a constant concern. Like, you could go through the top 10 on Draft Express or any other DraftNik website you want to go on.
There are no other DraftNik websites.
I believe that's all I go on, but just if you have your preferences. But so, it's so many of these guys, one of their fundamental flaws is shooting, which to me just, I understand, because a lot of these guys are crazy level athletes that when they're younger, they can get to the rim at will, or for big guys, they can just physically impose themselves on the game and not really have to worry about stepping out and hitting a 15 footer. But it's that a fundamental part of basketball has become such a huge concern for so many of these guys that come out of, and it's both out of AAU and out of Europe or wherever you could think of, that shooting is a lost art in a sense. There are very few guys that are coming out ready to drop bombs from deep.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I kind of said this last year when we were scouting Joel Embiid. I almost think, especially with big guys, guys who are great natural athletes but who pick up the game late almost have an advantage, because when you're younger and you're playing high school basketball and you're playing AAU basketball, especially for these big men, they can kind of get away with bad habits because they're so much they're at such an athletic advantage. You're physically dominant. So learning, you know, really working on your footwork in the post, really working on your counter moves, it's not really as necessary because you're going to dominate anyway. So a guy like Embiid, who's got great natural footwork through his you know, spending his childhood playing volleyball and soccer, for him to pick up the game late and not have those habits, I don't want to say it's a benefit because, I mean, experience is a big part of basketball, but it almost helps them prevent them from getting into bad habits that are sometimes hard to break once the level of competition increases. And I think for a lot of these guys, it's you know, on the wing, on the perimeter, it's frequently the same. But I mean, you're talking about a guy in Mike Carter Williams who, and he had the shoulder injury, and he could shoot for, you know, quite a bit of time while he was rehabbing. But it's again, it's hard to really know how much he would have improved if he didn't have this injury. But by the same token, I mean, you're talking about a guy who is, what, 23? 23,
I believe.
23. Yeah, you know, he's 23. And you just haven't seen real drastic improvement over the 3 years that we've been watching him, because he really didn't play his first year at Syracuse. So over 3 years that we've really been watching him, you just haven't seen that kind of improvement that would give you confidence that it's going to be here during his 24, 25, and 26-year-old seasons.
Yeah, well, I think the only counter to that as far as MCW and Roten is Roten's jump shot and his form just gives me nightmares, as the inconsistency there is almost hard to believe. At some nights it looks like he has a different form every time he lets it go, and there are outliers, like the other night against Phoenix he hit 4 3-pointers, and his Brett Brown even commented that he really liked his form and that he kept his elbow locked and the footwork was good. Man, I've never seen someone whose form is so erratic from one shot to the next.
No, it's kind of amazing. He had a game in November where I think he went 4 from 6 from 3-point range. And it was during that like 4 or 5 game stretch at the beginning of the season where he really shot the ball better. And everyone thought maybe an offseason work had fixed that. He went on to shoot 22% for the rest of November. And then he had another game like that in December where he shot 4 for 6. I think he shot, if you take that game out, he shot 24% from 3 in December. So again, he went 4 for 9 the other night, the first game in January. Since then, he's gone 2 for 14 from 3-point range. So he has these one game a month where you go, oh wow, he looks like an actual NBA 3-point shooter. This is great. But he's never been able to sustain that. And I'm not really sure how much progress he's made outside of being really streaky.
Yeah, and some people would point to that as, oh, well, it's that he's very young and perhaps over time it'll be more consistent. But like you said, there's just nothing tangible to suggest that he's ever going to be able to string these games or just stretches together with any semblance of consistency.
No, and you really can't have consistency until you have consistency in your form. Mm-hmm. And you're right, his form is almost seemingly different every time. He seems like he does a little bit better job of that in practice, which gives me a slight bit of hope. But until he's able to really put that in games, it's hard to have real confidence. But all this said, you know, we kind of had this discussion, you know, future point guard MCW or Roten. If I had to choose a side, it would be MCW. I think in terms of what you're going to want for a point guard, I think Michael is better at getting guys into their spots, better at hitting guys in their shooting pockets and in rhythm. So if he's able to shoot his jump shot, I like him in that role better. But that being said, if my answer, who's my future point guard, right now, unless one of them shows drastic improvement, it's probably none. It's C, none of the above. And I think, I think you brought up a good point. The trade of Drew Holiday and drafting Mike Carter-Williams, you know, that day to be his replacement kind of put a little bit of unrealistic expectations on him. And then he went out and he won Rookie of the Year and drastically outplayed his draft position. So now all of a sudden, we're not rating him on the 11th pick. You know, we're not rating him on a guy that the Sixers, they didn't tank for Michael Carter-Williams. He was the result of Doug Collins' incompetence. So they didn't, this isn't part of their rebuild. This isn't why we went through horrible seasons to acquire Michael Carter-Williams. He was a late lottery pick. But because of those two factors, we've kind of vaulted him up now to, if he doesn't work out, then the rebuild's failing. When it really doesn't make a whole lot of logical sense, but it's the way a lot of fans have taken it right now. And I think that's probably, you know, I was not a Michael Carter-Williams fan when they drafted him. When he came out and he played the way he did to start last year, I kind of took a lot of flack for that. But I didn't really change my opinion all that much outside of acknowledging the fact that he was playing better than I expected. I still had some of the same concerns. So I think we kind of need to stay a little bit level on that. And the fact that he played better than his draft slot doesn't mean all of a sudden that our reliance on him is more.
Yeah. And I think one more thing that really contributes to this discussion is the body language thing, where Michael Carter-Williams, when the team is playing poorly or he's playing poorly, he does have a tendency to let his shoulder slump and he might not get back on defense, and he lets it get to his head a little bit. Then the flip side of that is when they are playing well and things are going well, he's fired up and he's leading traffic and leading his teammates. And that's not something that necessarily bothers me that much. I like that he is so in tune with the game that he gets caught up in the emotion with it. Now, as he grows older and as he matures, he needs to work on kind of getting a handle of that and grabbing the reins himself rather than letting the emotions play him. But I like that he cares so much, seemingly, about play to play, game to game, everything that's happened. He feels ownership and responsibility for what's happening. And I think that's something that's been portrayed as a negative, but can easily be flipped around and seen as a positive in regards to how he approaches the game.
Right. And I don't look at MCW. I don't worry about his character.
No.
Like you said, you talked about his body language. I think that's frustration. I don't think that's annoyance with his teammates. I don't think that's anything of that sort. I think his teammates like him. And to me, that's the key. I think it's kind of natural for a second-year player who's in a situation to be frustrated at times. As long as that doesn't affect his play, and as long as it doesn't rub his teammates the wrong way, then I think we tend to make a little bit more of that than is really there. You know, I think he's working on his jump shot. I think I think he has a good mindset and a good work ethic to him. There are just some guys who they can work on their jump shot over and over and over, and they just don't have the touch. They're never able to develop that consistency. They're never able to develop, they're never able to keep their form when a play breaks down or when a defender's closing out on them or when they're shooting on the move. There's a whole lot of reasons beyond, you know, how much work you've put in. And he might just be one of those guys who's never going to have that touch. And I certainly question that. And because of that, I question his long-term fit, because I really do think you need a guy who can play well off the pick and roll, who can operate well as a catch and shoot shooter, and who can, you know, who can really generate for his teammates off the pick and roll, which right now isn't Michael Carter-Williams' strength. So I question all of that and his future fit, but I don't think that's a condemnation on his work ethic or who he is as a person or his body language or anything like that.
No. And one thing that always makes me laugh is an example that I saw both when he was drafted and since, in regards to learning to shoot over time, is Jason Kidd, who came out of Cal and was pretty much a non-shooter and eventually turned into a pretty reliable threat from deep when Dallas went to the finals and beat the first iteration of Bronze Miami Heat. But it's easy to forget that Jason Kidd was a Hall of Fame level player and talent, right, even without developing that jump shot. Like, he carried a pretty mediocre Nets team to the NBA Finals and was like an MVP caliber player in his prime. So to suggest that Michael Carter-Williams is going to eventually, or anybody else for that matter, is going to eventually develop a jumper because Jason Kidd did it in an 18-year career in the league is just a little ridiculous on its face.
Right. And I think, you know, I think a couple things. First of all, Jason Kidd, he had his greatest success playing with Keith Van Horn in New Jersey, playing with Dirk, playing with guys who are really face-up bigs when you're looking at Michael Carter-Williams and you're building him around Joel Embiid. I think that's the first thing. And second of all, you know, there are edge cases. Anytime we talk about an absolute, there isn't really no absolute in sports. People who say that generally like to hear themselves talk more than they're saying an actual thing. But that being said, the edge cases exist for a reason. It's because their other attributes are so above ordinary, so exceptional.
You make up a word there.
Hi, I speak English. They're so exceptional that they can overcome that. And you look at Jason Kidd, and yeah, Michael Carter-Williams is good in the open court. Jason Kidd was an all-time great in the open court. He might be one of the top 5 point guards ever in the open court. Yeah, Michael Carter-Williams has a lot of defensive tools, and sometimes he puts that together. But Jason Kidd was a shutdown defender. And even in the half court, Jason Kidd was a far superior passer than Michael Carter-Williams is. Far better at seeing over the defense, you know, making skip passes across court, operating off the pick and roll, even playing a drive and kick style offense. He was really better at every part of the game than Michael Carter-Williams. So yes, Jason Kidd, first of all, he was able to improve that shot. I don't think that's necessarily the ordinary. I don't think that's something that happens as frequently as we think we are. I think even just looking at his improvement, I think is an edge case. But the fact that he was able to have success without that jump shot, he was extremely unique in that regard.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people have pointed to, well, Joel Embiid might have potential as a shooter and be able to stretch the floor a little bit. But I think, sure, you can use him to space the floor in situational opportunities. But if you take him away from the basket, I think you're taking him away from the area where he has the most value, where he can be that dominant post-up player that beats guys one-on-one or commands double teams and then kicks out to guys who are open. And so somebody like Michael Carter-Williams, as you've said, if he wants to stick around long-term, that's really something he has to work on to really play to the strengths of the guys they already have in and hopefully the guys they eventually bring in to supplement.
Right. Moving on, you kind of brought up Nerlens Noel, and he's probably a good person to talk about next. I guess we all kind of know Nerlens on defense right now. He's not necessarily putting up the block numbers that I think many expected. Well, he's still putting, I think, 4-5% block rate, which is a good number. But his defensive impact, I think, we all understand. It's I haven't looked up the numbers recently, but I think it's like top 15 in terms of field goal percentage defended at the rim. He's playing really, really well as a team defender rotating. But his offensive game, what you have seen, what you haven't seen, you know, it's obviously a huge work in progress. But I guess talk about that and what kind of progress you think he's made.
Yeah, I think he has gotten better at, well, and this might also be a product of coaching too, in that they're not trying to post him up as much and they're getting him to face up and attack guys with speed. And he has success with it. He's had some success going left and just beating guys by reacting before they can. I think the problem with that is sometimes he almost goes too fast and he looks like he's trying to overcompensate. And that leads to, obviously, his hands have been a big issue. That leads to him kind of fumbling the ball and kicking it out of bounds or giving it up to the other team in play. But there are certainly some signs that he's improving on that end. It's still fairly ugly on most nights, but that continues to be a work in progress. I think where I've seen some real signs of improvement is rebounding lately, whether he's actually grabbing the rebounds himself or he's getting a hand on it and tipping it out to a teammate. He's been around the ball more than he looked to be, both in preseason and in the beginning stages of the regular season. Now, I wonder if having someone like Aldemir in practice could help in that regard, where he's dealing with someone that clearly is kind of a master at positioning himself for rebounds, because Aldemir is not exactly an athletic freak and he is still all over the glass. So I think there might be some benefit there to having to battle with guys like that in practice. But other than that, I just want to see him kind of steadily improve here. I'm not expecting him to ever be more than a minor offensive player who thrives on rim runs and just quick little moves. He's never going to be a post-up threat in my eyes.
Right. No, and I think, you know, they use him as a post-up threat a little more than I would have expected at Kentucky 2 years ago. And I think they've largely abandoned that with the Sixers. And they've, like you said, they've kind of replaced that instead with a little bit of a face-up game, which makes sense considering his athletic gifts. He's quicker than virtually any person who's ever going to try to defend him, with the exception of maybe Anthony Davis. So trying to get him comfortable in that regard and, you know, taking really one or two power dribbles and trying to get to the rim makes sense. He's had some success doing that. It's very intermittent. Like you said, he's had more going left than I expected. But for everyone he makes it, there's three or four that are wild, out of control, and really have little chance. Even the ones he does make, it seems like, I don't want to say they're luck, but it seems like you're surprised when they go in. But I think he shows, you know, I certainly his ball handling has a long way to go, and it really his strength in his hands. He gets stripped quite a bit. When he's bumped, he gets dislodged very easily. And those are all things that you hope over time, not in, you know, just last offseason, but over 2, 3, 4 years, as he grows and his body physically matures, that you hope that maybe not become completely fixed, but are not as big of problems as they are now. His jump shot has probably been better than I expected. And don't misinterpret that and think I'm saying it's good. It's certainly not, but I think he's shooting like 26% from mid-range. From 10 to 16 feet, which is a little closer to mid-range. But for a guy, and I went back and I watched the tape on this, he legitimately did not take one jump shot at Kentucky.
That's so amazing.
So for a guy who didn't take a jump shot, and granted, he only, you know, he got injured in February, so he only played half a year. But for a guy to not take one jump shot, and they had a couple that were tagged as jump shots, but they ended up being like hooks out of post moves or things of that sort. 7 foot shots that pretty much got mislabeled. So for a guy who didn't attempt a jump shot in college to come in here and shoot 26.5%, I don't like his form. Frankly, if I would have taken a year off to rebuild a jump shot, that's not what I would have come away with.
It's pretty hitchy looking. It
definitely is. It seems like he tried to copy KG and he just kind of like failed at it. And it's pretty well known that, Noel, a Boston native, looks up to KG quite a bit. And I say that just on the similarity of their jump shots. And he hasn't said that he has, but it wouldn't shock me if he saw that and said, that's how I want to shoot. And there's some merit to it because it's pretty much unblockable. But the problem is if you got it past the defender, but it's still not going in the basket. So I'm not in love with his jump shot form, but if it's something he can get consistent, then, you know, more power to him, and who am I to complain? But it's probably shown a little more than I expected. But really right now, I want to see, like you said, I want to see the game slow down for him, which right now it's not. And I want to see upper body strength, and that's just going to take years.
Yeah, it's hard to, you can't accelerate that part of it, just like, we're not going to be able to accelerate to the time when Michael Carter Williams is a respectable shooter that teams will have to deal with. I think the reason I've kind of just glossed over his offense is because even on his best day, I don't think he's ever going to be a guy that you're necessarily running offense for. He's going to get his offense through putbacks and rim runs and stuff that just kind of comes naturally through the flow of the game.
He's 6'11" and athletic, and he'll accidentally get the ball near the hoop sometimes.
Right. Like, and to bring up a comp, I don't know that he'll ever be Tyson Chandler, but Tyson Chandler has pretty much solely gotten his points by setting hard screens and then diving to the rim and catching alley-oops and finishing putbacks. That's all he does. Right. But he is still a very impactful player defensively, and he's been a valuable piece on a championship team. And I think if Nerlens Noel comes out of this and he's no better than Tyson Chandler, then I think that's a win overall.
Right. No, and I think, especially offensively, Tyson Chandler is an upside. And I think what you brought up there with the setting a pick and diving to the basket, it probably brings up my one legitimate concern, the one thing that is worse than I expected, and that's been his hands.
They are god-awful.
And when you're talking about a guy who is going to get his baskets cutting to the basket, diving to the basket off of pick and dives, off of offensive rebounds, off of alley-oops, that to me is the most concerning part of his offense so far. And, you know, whether or not you can drastically improve that, clearly getting stronger, I think, can help. You know, more experience, maybe catching the ball in traffic can help. But I'm not sure if this is something that, you know, this to me is a legitimate concern. When I talk about whether or not something's improvable, to me it's not me saying it can't be improved, but it to me is a legitimate concern.
Yeah, so I guess we'll just have to see how that kind of plays out. There was a play last night where I believe it was Robert Covington had the ball. They were just starting a possession, and he threw it to Nerlens at the top of the key, and he looked like someone threw a hand grenade at him. And it was just, I don't think I've ever seen a guy. Kwame Brown, actually, it's the one area he reminds me of Kwame Brown, young Kwame Brown, where he just has brick hands.
New rule, if you ever compare Kwame Brown or Nerlens Noel to Kwame Brown again, you are trigger not coming back on the show. You are not coming back. Well, that's it. You're warned.
Well, I think Nerlens has much bigger hands than Kwame, so I think that's something that could be coached. Kwame's problem is his hands are, from my memory, they're disproportionately small in comparison to the rest of his body, which is kind of a funny thing. I would like to see a picture where he holds his hands up and see if that's the case. But so you hope that that's a thing that can be coached. And maybe it's just, right. It also could just be one of those speed of the game type things where he didn't even get a full season of college competition. And now he sat a year out and is trying to acclimate to having the best players in the world to go up against night after night after night after night. And without necessarily the best teammates around him too, which allows teams to just throw pressure at him knowing that he has this weakness right now. So
yep.
I think there's certainly room for improvement. Whether it actually happens, we'll have to wait and see.
No, and he was, you know, they added the hand measurement to the NBA combine recently, and it's measuring from thumb to pinky. And he did measure out above average, so he does not have Kwame Brown hands. so let Kwame Brown's name never be brought up.
Apologies, Nerlens. I don't want to lump you in with him, but that's just the first guy I think of when I think of terrible hands.
Okay. We've kind of gone longer than expected, which always happens. We wanted to get into draft discussion. So instead, we're kind of going to have a teaser draft discussion right now. Looking at the Sixers, and right now, you know, you're talking about a team who actually has a third worst record, but you're hoping ends up in a top one or two. Let's say, just looking at the top of the draft, let's right now focus on big men, actually, because we're so limited on time. Jahlil Okafor, Karl Towns, who you got?
At this point, I have to say Okafor. I think you're in agreement with me there in that he is the guy who's the clear cut. If in 5 years, one of these guys is going to be a dominant level player, that's who it's going to be. He just is so big and so skilled that the Sixers are at a point in the rebuild where they have to get the star. And while you hope that Embiid can be one of those, this guy looks like he could be one as well, and it would be tough to pass up on him.
Yeah, and I think if Joel Embiid were a 5-year veteran and he was already dominant and you didn't have the injury concern, both in the back and in the navicular in his foot. I probably go Carl Towns. I think they're really, really close. I really like Carl Towns. I love a big man who can potentially impact the game on both sides of the court. I think Carl Towns can be that. He can post up. He can shoot. He can pass. He can block a shot. He moves his feet better than Okafor. Maybe not quite great enough to be a really great, you know, perimeter defender as a power forward, but he moves his feet better than Okafor. He's got a very good skill set. He's got a very good, you know, build. He's got good length, athleticism. I have a lot of confidence he is going to be a good player. That being said, to me, the only way these 2 years are a failure is if in 3 years you don't have a dominant player. If you're still sitting here in 3 years going, man, we don't have a guy to build around. And as much as I like Joel Embiid, and if I was rating a prospect coming into the draft, a healthy prospect, I have Joel Embiid rated above both Okafor and Towns. And, you know, I had Joel Embiid number one on my board from December of last year on, even after the injury. So I'm a big Joel Embiid fan, but the fact is right now he is a question mark. He's not guaranteed, and I think most of the concern is the injury. But if I end up in 3 years and I have two dominant big men, I'll live with that problem. Either you figure out whether they can play together, you move one. I need a dominant player. I need a difference maker.
Yeah.
And when I look at Jahlil Okafor, I'm confident in his ability to be a dominating post presence, even in the NBA. And to me, his real skill, his swing skill, as Rich Hoffman calls it, is his passing out of the post, passing out of the double team. You know, we have, like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I looked at it. He had been hard doubled in the post 40 times, something around there. He had yet to commit a turnover. This is a guy who, he runs an offense from the post. You know, he really sees the game. And it's really like a point guard playing from the post. His passing is something that you just don't see in big men, particularly at 19 years of age. But his combination of footwork, size, and passing, it's really something to watch.
Yeah, and I think I have a better feel for what he's going to do than Towns, only because of Kentucky's substitution patterns this season. I believe, just like you do, that Towns is going to be a good player. I think his areas of strength are much different than Okafor's, but I think he'll be a good player nonetheless. It's harder to get a read on him because of how he's used at Kentucky. So I guess it'll be easier for me to make a declaration as the season goes on and I kind of get more of a feel for him and just see him more, because these hockey style substitutions where they're coming off 3, 4, or 5 guys at a time sometimes just aren't very unique within college basketball or in basketball in general.
Yep. No, I mean, it would be great to see him get real good 8, 10, 12 minute runs and see how he responds to, you know, everything from getting winded to the coaches being able to throw more defenders at him, other coaches making substitutions. I mean, it's incredibly effective what they're doing. Their defense at Kentucky is something that I haven't really seen at a collegiate level in quite some time. And part of that's personnel, but part of that's also always having a fresh body, fresh legs out on the court. So I can't fault him for it. But as somebody who's trying to evaluate a prospect, I would prefer to see Carl Towns out there for more extended runs and really just playing more minutes overall. You know, that being said, I can't deny the fit questions. And again, if I was looking to get a second piece on this team, Carl Towns makes a lot of sense. I can't deny the fit problems, especially on the defensive end. I think both Embiid and Okafor can develop at least 15-foot, you know, reins on their jump shot to maybe not space the floor as much as you know, Dirk and Dallas do, or Kevin Love in Cleveland does, but enough to run a functional offense around, especially when you have two guys who can pass as well as they do. I'm less worried about offensively, because I think when you come down to court each and every time, there aren't very many teams that have two real legitimate post defenders. So you're going to have a mismatch every time. It's really on the defensive side, whether he can move his feet on the perimeter, whether he can defend the pick and roll. That really has me questioning. And I think that's a legitimate question, but I right now cannot pass on that talent.
Yeah, and I think the beauty of Okafor and Embiid on offense is not just or post-up game, but they both, especially Okafor, has shown that he can hit that 15 to even maybe 18-footer off the glass with regularity. And he's caught passes from Justice Winslow and Tyus Jones, and it's automatic. He doesn't even think about what he's going to do. The ball hits his hands, and he's going up into a shot, and he makes it more often than not. And to me, that's extremely encouraging for a kid his age, especially when we talked about big guys can kind of fall into these bad habits where they just bully everybody down low and never really learn moves. But he really has crafted an arsenal on the offensive end that I think no matter what level he's playing at, it's going to make him a tough cover.
I mean, his footwork, his diversity of offensive moves, his counter moves, his recognition, all that is just at such... I mean, it would be one thing if he were only a good post player, a good post passer, but they're at such levels of greatness that it's really something to watch. And it's, again, like I said, it's hard for me to pass on even with fit concerns. Anyway, I think that's probably a good place to wrap it up. You know, certainly we will talk a heck of a lot more about the draft going on, but once again, thanks for coming on, and we'll hopefully make this more regular.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and hopefully I'm not banned after the Tommy Brown mention.
You get one screw up, but after that you will be able to.
Okay, fair enough.
You've been listening to the Sixers Beat right here on LibertyBallers.com and LibertyBroadcast.co.
Did I attract clientele? My mic check is life or death, breathing a sniper's breath. I exhale the yellow smoke of Buddha through righteous steps, deep like the shining, sparkle like a